Hello and welcome to episode 41 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me is Andrew Brokus in,
Austin,
where are you?
Austin, Texas.
How's that going for you?
So far, so good. I've only been here a couple days. It's, Sunday now when we're recording? I came here from Las Vegas on Thursday, so I'm, but my girlfriend's here for the summer, so I'll be here for about a month or so, and then we'll probably do a road trip back to Pittsburgh, much in the same way that we did one across the country. So keep an eye on the blog, and maybe if we stop anywhere interesting on the way back, I'll let you know how that's going.
But it's not just the two of us this week, is it?
No, we also have joining us from Trondheim, Norway, Gareth Chantley.
That's right. I'm here.
Thanks for co-hosting with us, Gareth. How's it going?
It's going really well. I'm well-fed and well-taken care of in probably the safest, sleepiest town in the world, enjoying the high quality of life in Norway for another week.
So you haven't been in any casinos where people put guns on the table? You haven't been followed home by prostitutes?
No.
The Far Cry.
How did you know the followed home by prostitute story? I don't remember telling you that.
Maybe there's more than one, because you definitely don't.
Okay. Nothing like that. This has got to be I'm actually already suffering from the wanderlust, because it really is not that interesting a place, to be honest.
Well, let's fill people in on the backstory, because the last time we talked to you, you were in Istanbul.
Yep, that's right. I met a girl in South America named Anna, and we are together, and she lives here. So I've come here for about a month, and she's actually going to stay. She's, believe it or not, in a cruel twist of irony, she's a high school teacher. So I don't know how these things happen, but yeah, she's staying here for the next 5 months or so, but we're going to try and make it work. And then after that, we plan on traveling for an extended period of time.
Where are you going to be for those 5 months? You're not staying in Norway.
No, I've been enjoying Norway summer, and I'm doing that thing to make the quotes with my fingers. I'm definitely not cut out to stay here for much longer, I would say. I'm going to Ireland on Friday, and I'm going to be covering the UK IPT Galway stop there for like 2.5 weeks.
Which is a PokerStars tournament?
It is a PokerStars tournament that has picked up a sponsor in Full Tilt in some sort of weird melded confusion of branding that I will hopefully sort out. And I think I'm the only one on the team there who can both spit out a sentence and talk strategy. So I'm hoping to sort of leverage my position over the 2 weeks, maybe, you know, to go beyond my role as a blogger.
Nice.
I hear that they have Gus Hansen coming in for like an extended period. The woman who hired me was like, yeah, Gus Hansen's coming for the whole time, 100%. I was like, yeah, I don't know if you've read his bio, but Gus Hansen is coming to your like venue 100%. That doesn't sound like So, but anyways, yeah, hopefully getting to interview him, that'd be a coup.
Yeah.
And then after that, I'm just going to Mexico. I'm going to Canada for my sister's wedding, the good brother that I am. And then I'm going to Mexico for 3 months or so.
And this is
where in Canada is the wedding? This is the Thinking Poker Podcast. You can't just say Canada. You have to be more specific.
Right. So she and her wonderful Gareth endorsed fiance, Alex, are getting married at a place called Sanctuary, which is the church / like place of activism for homeless Toronto people that they both work at and have at different times been, you know, youth pastors, if you want. So they're getting married there. I think it's going to be a riot, because there's going to be people who are dressed in wedding gear, and then there's going to be like the alcoholic from Jane and Finch or whatever that they, you know, take bagels to on Wednesdays. Like those people are invited to the wedding as well. And then there's a reception at Pioneer Village in Toronto, which Canadian listeners will probably know if they live in or have been near Ontario. So
and they're all invited.
I don't know if the listeners are invited, but if you've been, you know, taken in off the street by this church, then yeah, then you can come to the wedding. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and the UK IPT tournament is going to be the second one that you've covered for PokerStars blog?
Yeah, I covered the first one in Spain, in Marbella. I didn't get fired, and I love it. It's so awesome, mostly because there's very little oversight, except for like... except for like a brief dressing down that my, not me, but my partner in crime, Rod, he got dressed down over Skype by our like superior over too much punning. There are too many puns going out in the headlines. So apart from that minor scandal, like, yeah, I basically can write whatever I want. So like, I think I started day five coverage with like a Wittgenstein reference. I mean, like, it's really awesome. There was a guy, an Irish guy, getting drunk at the table and he was going really deep and he's apparently pretty infamous. I don't know. I just like basically wrote it how I would if it wasn't a corporate blog, you know. So yeah, it's really great. I really like this job.
So you're basically the Hunter S. Thompson of Poker Stars at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if they, as long as the people paying me the money don't read what I'm writing, I think it'll continue. So
the UK IPT Galway is decadent and depraved, is that what you're saying?
I've been reading all of Joyce, so you know I'm prepared to bring some color and flavor to the coverage, I think.
What goes into covering these tournaments? I mean, do you arrive there before the tournament starts and like are you mostly just covering what goes on in the actual tournament? Are you talking about the venue also?
Yeah, I don't know. We didn't talk much about the venue last time in the coverage. It's, I think this time we will be, because venue is, you know, Full Tilt branded. It's not a casino. They're like erecting like a convention space, and it was going to be Poker Stars branded up until like 6 weeks ago. So I don't know what happened there. That'll be some sort of story. I imagine will need explaining.
I always just figure that those things are tax benefits. Like those are all tax plays, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, like they're. I think there's a lot of duplication in the staff there, so you know I'm not sure if anyone actually knows, but yeah, so we'll talk about the venue there because they're doing a lot of other things poker related. We'll talk about the town obviously as like a destination.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant to ask, is like is it kind of like travel writing also, or is it mostly just poker writing?
I think it's all in the introductory references, like the first paragraphs introducing the day are, yeah. You know, I'm gonna say, hey, we're in Galway where this person in Dubliners wanted to go because it's so beautiful or whatever. Yeah, and then get straight into the like poker news style updates.
Yeah, it kind of struck me as a bit of a missed opportunity that there's all these poker tournaments in you know, different kind of locations around the world. And it'll probably get mad at me if I refer to them as exotic, but all these different locations around the world. And there's not a lot of effort made to, I guess, to encourage the people who are there to play the tournament to do other things in that area. I remember actually in the year that the EPT final was in Madrid, they did actually organize a couple. I think they did like a segue tour of the city and maybe one other thing. And they made a couple of attempts to like do some kind of organized outing. But it always kind of seemed to me that there might be room on, like in the Poker Stars blog seems like a perfect place for it, that there might be room to do some kind of, even in advance of the tournament, something telling people like, here's an example of a day trip that you could take from Galway to, I don't know, some like coastal city in Ireland, or I don't even know where Galway is, but things to make it more of a trip than just just playing poker in a place where people have different accents.
No, I agree 100%, and that's what I'm gonna be trying to bring. Like, I'm really, yeah, hoping to just distinguish myself basically. And Galway is on the coast; it's on the west coast, but there are like a group of islands relatively close you can reach by ferry where people like speak Irish instead of what they call English, and then they brew some sort of, now this I think should get the exotic moniker, whatever, they brew like really exotic high alcohol content alcohol and have like their own culture or whatever. Yeah, so I have that in mind as an example of a place you can go. Hopefully I'll be throwing that in. Like, honestly, I'm hoping to get in front of the camera as well. There should be some camera equipment. So
yeah, I mean, I'm guessing they've determined that these kinds of things really aren't that big of a draw, but it seems like something you might want to do as part of your advertising. I mean, not you personally, of course, but that one might want to do as part of one's advertising for a tournament like this is also emphasize like, here are the things that you could do while you're in that area. I mean, I'm probably unique among poker players, although I don't think I should be, in the sense that, you know, for me to travel, especially to like a different country for a poker tournament, I'm not going to go solely because I think that tournament will be good. Like, I think the expenses entailed are simply too high to justify like flying across the Atlantic or something just like solely to play a poker tournament. So I think if you're not, if, for me, if I don't feel like I'm going to get something else out of the trip besides just the opportunity to play a poker tournament, then I'm probably not going to go. So I think like emphasizing here are other things that you'd be able to get out of being in this region. Here are other things that you could do, kind of take the work out of it. Like you're saying, I mean, put together an itinerary for here's how you would get over to this monastery, and here are the ferry times for the days off from the tournament, or you know, just to kind of set it up to make it drop real easily into the itineraries of people who are coming to play the tournament. I would think that would be a draw, if not for the poker players themselves, then at least like for their families. It seems like there's a fair number of the recreational poker player set for whom poker is part of a vacation, and they're looking for things to occupy their families so that they can play more poker while they're there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the people reading the updates like that stuff too, even if they're a world away, you know?
Right.
It's not uninteresting to them. You know, they don't want just hand histories with stack sizes.
Yeah. So the big ethical talk in the poker world this week has been about an incident that arose at the World Series of Poker main event. And you know, I think we talked about this a bit off the air, and I think our consensus is that really we don't have enough of the details to talk about this situation specifically, which a lot of you probably know. It involved Doc Sands at the end of day one of the main event. As best this incident has been reported, and again, I think we're going to talk about this kind of as a hypothetical rather than assuming that we know the details of the exact situation that occurred. But it seems like what happened is there was a player at the table who decided that for personal reasons, he was going to have to leave the tournament. I think it was that his father had passed away suddenly, like during the day while he was playing the tournament. And so he decided he was not going to be able to finish out playing the tournament. He was going to be leaving at the end of day one. And I guess he had been sitting next to Doc Sands. And the assertion anyway is that he had said, I'm going to have to leave. I don't know why he didn't just leave immediately, but I guess he decided he was going to finish out playing day one and then quit the tournament. And he decided that what he wanted to do, again, allegedly, is to just to dump off his chips, to get rid of his chips. And apparently he said something to Doc Sands along the lines of, you know, if anyone's going to get these chips, I want them to be you, or I'd rather see them go to you than to anyone else. And you know, whether or not it was related to that conversation, we don't really know. But I think, you know, Doc either just felt bad for him, if that it would be the non-cynical interpretation, or the cynical interpretation is that, you know, in order to encourage a chip dump, that Doc Sands said that he would give this player a 1% free roll of anything that he, Doc Sands, won in the tournament. And then a rather suspicious hand took place between the two, where the player ended up calling off all of his chips with five high on the turn. It turned out that both his five and his three were live, and he actually rivered a five, so he ended up crippling Doc Sands rather than dumping his chips to him. But you know, again, I dropped the word allegedly quite a few times in there, and all we have is like second or third hand reports of the way this situation went down. So I think the more interesting thing for us to talk about, rather than to try to form a conclusion on whether or not either of these players' behaviors in particular were unethical, is to talk about the situation that I think does actually come up more commonly than you might think, where someone who's perhaps not completely familiar with the ethics of poker, right? This guy whose father had died, he's probably in some kind of you know, understandably emotional state where he's maybe not thinking clearly about the poker tournament. And B, it sounds like he was a recreational player who maybe wasn't real familiar with the way, like the proper procedure for things in a poker tournament. You know, how should you handle a situation where you believe that a player is trying to dump chips to you? I mean, is what's your obligation here? Is it okay for you to accept a chip dump if a guy says, I'm going to give you my chips, and you tell him, you know, let's start there. I mean, if a player says something to you along the lines of, if anyone's going to get my chips, I want them to be you, or I want that to be you, do you have an obligation, like immediately at that point, even before he's actually done anything, do you have an obligation to speak up to say something to him or to say something to a tournament administrator?
What your obligations are is a little bit tricky, but I do think there are a lot of ways in practice both to not go along with him in the cheating plan and to make it clear that there's a right way to play and there's a way to play that's according to the rules of the game, not to mention the ethics of the game, and that, you know, chip dumping is you know, violates both the letter and the spirit of the law. Yeah, a common thing that comes up is you go to a new casino, people get friendly with you. There are regulars there who never bet each other on the river. You know, somebody lets you off the hook in a pot or something. Maybe they check back on the river when they had a betting hand because, you know, they see betting on the river as something that's, you know, overly fierce to do in a poker game. Yeah, you know, that's happened to me several times. And I just say, like, go ahead and bet there and I'm going to bet against you. And like a friendly way to say this is I didn't come to the casino not to gamble. This was also like my standard yeah. response when I used to not chop and for a lot of reasons. And people would say, you don't want to chop. Da, 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 da. What's wrong with you? Are you some kind of shark? Are you a pro? I'd say like, look, I did not come to the casino to not gamble. Okay. Like, that's and I think there are a lot of things that Doc could have done to discourage it. And, you know, I think one ought to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he could have, what my go-to would be similar. I would say, let's just play poker. But what he shouldn't do is offer a 1% free roll in his main event. Like, I kind of think only two facts need to be shown here to make it super suspicious. One, that like Doc Sands finished Atlas Shrugged, and two, that he offered this guy a 1% free roll. Like, that just seems, one, for someone like Doc, he probably thinks quite highly of his ROI in the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, that easily could be worth between $200 and $300 to Doc.
Yeah, so 1% seems, and I don't know, there's no clear connection to charity here. Like, the guy doesn't...
Yeah, there's no indication that the guy, like, can't afford to bury his father or something.
Yeah, right. That was the appropriate harshness that I was looking for. I don't know, it smells... those two facts, knowing Doc is the self-interested individual that he appears to be, and the fact that he offered this without the context, I agree, we can't form conclusions. But
so just, much for my determination about not discussing this specific situation.
I don't have any other comments on the other things that happened, because, like, procedurally, I probably just am not the authority. But that particular point seems pretty questionable to me.
Yeah, I will say also that last I checked, Doc had not sort of publicly refuted any of the major claims, or at least most of the major claims, which usually makes me think that they're mostly true, but that's just a guess, and I'm not sure it's true.
Yeah, I mean, I can't...
I've already spent a lot of time on air sort of dumping on Doc, so I don't want to do too much of that here.
Yeah, I mean, crawling into a news, views, and gossips thread I kind of feel like you don't get a fair trial in that situation, especially not if
people have been bugging him on Twitter, though.
I mean, I'm not saying that there's nothing that he could potentially do, but I kind of understand that the liberals are just like, I don't actually owe people an explanation in the most literal sense of the word. And I think that, you know, anything I say is going to be used against me a lot more so than it's going to be used for me or is going to be read fairly. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are eager just to pillory him.
Do you think that's true, like he doesn't know an explanation because the guy actually hit a five, Andrew, or do you think that's incidental?
I mean, I think ultimately, like, it's the responsibility of the, like, I think there's a failure here on the part of the tournament staff more than there is on the part of anyone else, with the possible exception of the guy who's deliberately dumping off chips. But I'm kind of giving him a pass as, like, as a bereaved amateur. I'm giving right. him a bereaved amateur yeah. pass, which is essentially, like, yeah, obviously what he did is wrong, and it seems like he wasn't doing it in any way to benefit himself personally. It was just, like, bad decision making. Yeah. And it's kind of not as, like, I'm almost looking at him as like a non-factor here, or like I'm less interested in discussing the ethics of his actions, just because it seems like, A, there's a clear explanation for why he did what he did, and it doesn't seem like there's any indication he was actually motivated by that 1% free roll thing, and B, just that he's not, I don't know, likely to be listening to this podcast, nor are people who are listening to this yeah. podcast likely to be in his shoes. I think the biggest error is just, I mean, if this stuff is being openly discussed at the table, because it was reported by another player who was at the table, like, surely the dealer should have heard that this was going on also. So it sounds like the floor was called it, because this guy actually exposed his hand. This is part of how he ended up getting all in with 5-3 versus a7 on a king queen jack x board on the turn, is that he actually exposed his hand to Doc during the hand, and you know, basically told him, like, I'm gonna be all you have to do is raise, and showed him the cards. And so Doc raises him with a7 on that board, and he ends up calling with 5-3. And I mean, you could certainly look at it as, you know, Doc saying, well, I didn't tell the guy to show me his cards. I didn't tell the guy to call. I saw that I had the best hand, and I moved all in. And, you know, maybe in the strictest interpretation of the rules, that's true. Like, if the dealer is there and seeing all this happening and not saying anything, and the floor is called over, and they don't do anything about it. Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like the obligation is, it should have been on the tournament staff to stop the situation from getting to the point where it did.
Yeah, although, again, other players are often more able than they think to keep these sorts of situations from getting out of control.
Yeah, like, I don't understand how other people at the table didn't throw a bigger stuff while it was happening.
Yeah. Yeah, this is also, by the way, this is also a great time to, like, if you're a third player in the pot, not muck your hand, demand all-in protection, and make security come get your hand from you. Like if you see this happening, like, if I were the third player in the pot, I wouldn't fold. Like, I would just sit there and complain until something happened. And when you're in the right, these things usually end up, like, if you're polite about it, this is a great place to, good place to hold tight. I also think it's not so hard not to exploit another person's attempt to cheat with you. This has happened to me in the World Series, actually. I was, not this exact thing, but I was in the money, and I was sort of friendly with somebody two seats to my left who was obviously, you know, sort of a weekend warrior type who thought he was a lot better than he was. And, you know, he had a lot of sort of personal investment in it and believed himself to be one of a set of good poker players. And it was very important to him to be that kind of person. I was short stacked, middle position player raised. This is in the money. And I had aces, and the guy who raised had a lot of preflop tells, and I thought he was weak and would fold if I 3-bet, but would continuation bet almost all the time. And all the people to my left were pretty tight, so I thought this was a pretty obvious spot to just call before the flop, even though I was pretty short stacked. As it happens, this guy in the blinds actually did call. The flop came down 9-3 deuce, and he checked, kicked me under the table, and said, "Get out." Brutal. And then the guy in the middle bet. And I moved all in, because I'm not going to let that guy cheat everybody else out of, you know, it's just, I'm not going to be a party to that kind of thing. You know, it's, I think the only thing to do is, if I had a close decision, then it's like very hard to like weigh all the information. But I had a clear shoving hand. My plan, as far as I could tell, worked, except insofar as I had tight players to my left, and one of them actually found a pair of nines to wake up with in the small blind call. But yeah, I think I had no choice there but to shove. So I did. And yeah, I didn't get there. So, and then, as I walked away, he said, "What? I told you, man. I told you." And I just walked away. So, you know, it's just not that hard to not cheat at poker. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, how, like, Doc, being as savvy as he is, as experienced as he is, could probably feel like the dealer is in over their head. Like, he would know, okay, this dealer looks like they're not in tune to the gravity of what is going on. The tournament staff is overloaded with end of the day stuff. It's pretty easy to imagine that he would clue into the possibilities going on here. And what's so curious is, like, the hand history. I don't know if this throws doubt on the hand history as it was posted, but for this guy to be saying this stuff, to open under the gun, and then Doc to call next act, and no one else wants to play this pot, like, how did that happen? What are the odds that, like, everyone else was like, well, you know, good, pack up and count my stack, or, you know, color up these greens.
And then,
like,
and then the flop comes king, queen, jack, and then the guy bets before he shows his cards, and Doc calls. Like, so even if the guy's got a 75% range there, a7 is an underdog to that range. Like, this is why I'm so skeptical in the first place. The story just simply does not add up. I will say, with regards to your former point, I've played with a lot of people who play really slowly, or thought that there was no problem with playing really slowly all the time. I've never met one who was, like, really savvy about these things and sort of understood procedure and, you know, these sort of parts of poker that aren't written down in the rules, or that they don't sort of tell you on ESPN before they start showing things. So
yeah, maybe if, he, as a Randian reader, he may not be aware of the human side of the dynamic.
I'm trying, like, actually not to dump on him here. Like, I just think he's a very, very good poker player who studied the game itself and the mechanics of just the game of poker very closely, and more sort of cultural and procedural aspects of it are things that he hasn't bothered to learn about very much. You know, yeah, in some sense, I think that's okay. Sense. Yeah, so I actually didn't know that he reads Ayn Rand.
No, I wasn't trying to put words in your mouth. No. I was just trying to get my joke in.
I went through a pretty serious Ayn Rand phase, and then I turned 16.
Yeah, I mean, I did read The Fountainhead, by the way. I don't know. It's like a fine book. It's just like the philosophical writing is just strictly worse than like almost. No, I mean, it's like I'm not even saying like I think I could make an argument that there's almost nothing of value in the philosophical writing, but I don't even need to say that. It's just like, it's strictly worse than any number of like much better philosophical texts. So why would you read it? You know, like it's just.
Yeah, I was trying to decide in the joke about like finishing Atlas Shrugged, or I was going to go with who read Anthem for pleasure and not interest. Yeah, I read all those books, but not for pleasure. So
I think there are probably at least 500 listeners who really wish we would just start talking strategy right now. So let's do that.
Strategy segment brought to us by Tournament Poker Edge. And just looking through a lot of the videos that have gone up most recently on Tournament Poker Edge, you really get a sense of the breadth of stuff that's available out there in terms of having information and videos for players of all different stakes. So, you know, right now going up side by side, we have a win in a $55 50K guaranteed tournament reviewed by DannyN13. And going up alongside that is Mike Sauer's win in a $1,000 multi-entry FTOPS event. So you've got a $50 MTT and a $1,000 MTT both being discussed there. And then my most recent video is dealing with a $200 double chance WCOOP event. So that's either a $200 or a $400 tournament, depending on how many bullets you decide you want to fire. There definitely is material in here for people playing even smaller stakes than $50 tournaments. There's two different live sweats going up right now, one with Daryl Jace and Chris Moon, one with Jamie Kerstetter, both of them playing across a variety of stakes. So really, you know, no matter what you're currently playing, no matter what you're aspiring to play, you're going to find something on Tournament Poker Edge that speaks to the games that you're playing in and the things that you need to be working on right now. Strategy-wise, we've got first a mailbag question, and this one comes to us from Sean, who says, I consistently run into a certain problem and I'm stuck. The situation is playing second or bottom pair on dry flops. I try to think ahead as to what cards could come on the turn and river that I don't want to see, so I often bet the flop for protection. The problem I run into is in 1-2 and 2-5 games where I play, far too many people love to float to try to catch and I'm lost. What I mean by that is more times than not it's a limped pot and I feel like I'm trying to rep a bigger hand than I have because I would have raised pre-flop. I just feel like this is a weakness that I have and probably a lot of other players that sit at these lower limit games. So it sounds like the situation we're talking about is probably a multi-way limped pot. Maybe four or five people are seeing the flop, and you know, hero has something like 9-8 suited, and we get maybe a jack-9 deuce flop with two clubs out there, let's say. And so now hero is thinking, well, there's a good chance I have the best hand, but obviously there's a lot of bad turn cards for me. And so he's inclined to bet his hand for protection, but then once he gets called, he doesn't really know, well, am I up against a jack? Am I up against a flush draw? Am I up against a straight draw? Did the turn card hit my opponent or not? Is that the sense you guys get that this is the situation?
Didn't he specify dry boards or?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Subtract the flush draw.
Sorry. I was like, maybe I should not say that because Andrew's talked so long now. But
we can talk about both situations. But
right.
Yeah, I guess it's a case where he thinks there's a good chance he has the best hand, but he's not really sure whether or how to bet it for protection.
As always, you should be pretty happy to get called by nothing. So I want to distinguish floating and calling to see if you hit a pair, which are pretty different things. And so 2-5, no limit, that's my bread and butter game. And I love it when this happens. First, because the sort of person who does this is often not going to be very good at bluffing. So I often have a lot of profitable bluff catching opportunities later in the hand. And their bet sizing with top pair will be different from their bet sizing with, you know, a hand that they peeled on the flop, then didn't get there with. So I think it's great that you're getting called by no pair so often when you're betting with middle pair. A second thing I want to say is, if you're actually just having trouble playing the hand, and if your hand isn't strong enough to take up against a range that has some top pair and some naked overcards in it, then maybe you're playing too many pots out of position and maybe you shouldn't be limping the hand in the first place. Like, I know when I play in these situations, I often have a lot of good value betting opportunities later with an unimproved hand. I have good bluff catching opportunities later. And I have good folding opportunities later if I think that I'm getting called by a top pair. So if you don't see those opportunities happening, then it sounds like you're just having a hard time playing out of position, which, after all, is supposed to happen in poker. And if the times that you limp, then you hit a pair, then you have trouble when you get called on the flop, which is often, then all of a sudden it doesn't look like you have a profitable limp before the flop anymore. Because after all, it's hard to hit a pair in the first place. And if a lot of the time that that happens, you're not making money and you're hitting all these difficult spots, then probably you should just be folding, you know, whatever 9-7 offsuit, 9-8 suited, well, 9-8 suited, that's hard to think, but, you know, 9-8 offsuit or whatever that you're calling with in the first place.
Or maybe just not betting them. I mean, I think part of the problem here is it seems like our correspondent feels some obligation to bet his hand for protection. And, you know, simply feeling like you simply thinking I probably have the best hand is not sufficient reason to bet, particularly not in a limped pot. There are times when you want to bet either primarily or exclusively for protection, but they don't come up that often. I mean, generally in poker, when you're betting, you should be betting either to make hands that are worse than yours call a bet, or to make hands that are better than yours fold to a bet. And I tend to think of betting for protection as a third case where you're betting to make hands that are worse than yours fold. Because, of course, hands that are worse than yours still have some equity in the pot. Sometimes they can even have a lot. Like two bear overcards is going to have close to 25% equity in the pot. And if they have some kind of draw going along with that, that can get up to 30, 40, even 50% equity. So in those cases where you're talking about really high equity hands and making them fold, then it becomes better and better to bet for protection. But of course, those hands are less likely to fold, because if a guy has two overs and a flush draw, he realizes that his equity is probably pretty good and he's not going to fold it anyway. But I think particularly in a limped pot, what the scenario is generally that the amount of money in the pot is quite small compared to the amount of money that's still in the stacks. And when you're playing a big bet poker game like No Limit Hold'em, your objective should be to try to get the rest of the money that's in your stack, to try to get it in good, to try to create situations where you can put more money into the pot good. So if there's only $10 in the pot to start with, you don't want to end up spending $20, you know, put $20 into the pot bad trying to protect that $10. Oftentimes it can be better for you to let the flop check around and see what the turn card brings, and maybe you'll get more information from your opponents about what they have without you having to put any money into the pot at all. Maybe the turn card will be something that'll improve your hand. Maybe the turn card will create a second best hand such that now you'll feel more confident, or just make your opponents feel better about second best hands such that now you'll feel more confident value betting. So if we come back to that example I gave, like a jack nine deuce flop, you know, right now if you have a hand like 8-9, you can bet it. But if you get called, you might think, well, my opponents aren't going to call me, even though 8-9 is probably the best hand. Maybe they're not going to call you unless they either have 8-9 beat, like either a 9 with a better kicker or a jack, or if they have a hand like king-queen, which is like two overcards and a gut shot, has a good amount of equity against you, which means you're not really going to be in good shape against their calling range. But if you let the flop check around, one of a couple things could happen. One is that the turn card could create a situation where someone will be willing to put more money into the pot. Maybe the turn is a 6, and now someone who has 7-6 or ace-6 or 5-6 is willing to pay off a bet, whereas they would have just folded to a turn bet. Or the turn creates a draw for somebody, and now that person is willing to put money into the pot, drawing to only 9 or 12 outs with one card to come. And that's, you're going to be a pretty good favorite against a hand like that. The other thing that can happen that I think is what our correspondent is worried about is that the turn could be a bad card for you. Like, it could come a king and someone bets, and now he's like, well, I have to fold and I could have won the pot if I had just bet the flop. And that's true, but, you know, that's not costing you that much. It's costing you, I don't know, whatever the odds are of you winning if you had bet the flop, maybe 50 or 60%. It's costing you 50 or 60% of $10, and the the benefit you're getting from that is you're setting up a possibility where you can put something like $6 or $8 into the pot good on the turn, and possibly even more than that. So it's kind of like, well, do you want to take the pot that's there now, or do you want to create opportunities to make profitable decisions, whether they be bets or calls or folds later? And I think usually in a limped pot, when the pot is very small compared to the money that's still in the stack, you want to think more about how can I make good decisions with money that hasn't been bet yet, rather than how can I lock up the equity that I have in a very small pot.
I'm a little bit worried that you just said a lot of smart things, but some internally inconsistent things. So you started off by saying, this is a big bet game. We worry about our stacks, right? This is what we play for. And, you know, betting the flop with 9-8 is not always a great way to set up good whole stack scenarios. But then you went on to describe a lot of other ways just to win small pots or to get one bet out of somebody anyway. And I think if your situation isn't even good, if you flop a pair and let's say it checks 2/3 of the way around to you, and you think that you have reason to think you have the best hand, if you don't have a betting situation there, then I'm back to thinking maybe you shouldn't be calling the hand at all before the flop. You know, it looks like.
Maybe I should clarify that a little bit. Like if I'm limping with a hand like a 6-4 suited, it's not necessarily because I feel like I have to have a profitable spot every time I flop a pair of sixes. Part of my reason for playing a hand like 6-4 suited is if I can see the flop cheaply, I might be able to create a spot where I'm playing for stacks because I make a straight or because I make like a well-concealed trips or something like that. So it's kind of like even when you get an above average flop for you, like you flop middle pair with a pair of sixes, you don't necessarily it's not necessarily a reason not to play the hand just because you don't feel like it's a particularly profitable spot for you.
Yeah, that's fair. I do think that you do have some pretty good spots. So like it's not a reason to pass up a profitable flop bet that you might get one small bet in good later. Like if you get it in better later, then yes, that might be a reason. But you know, the sort of situation I have in mind is two people limp, you limp in late middle position with 9-8, somebody calls on the button who you know loves to peel, flop comes jack 9 deuce, and then it checks to you. I think often I would bet there, both because when I do get called, I have position against some of the people and I have a pretty good nose for when they're drawing and when they're not, and I'm happy to take a pair up against them. And second, if I get called just by the guy on the button who loves to call the flop for $7 in a 1-2 game or for $15 or $20 in a 2-5 game, and then the other people fold, I'm still happy with that because I have a pair of nines and he often has nothing, or a pair of fives that he, you know, a pocket pair of fives or ace deuce or, you know, the wrong end of a gut shot or something like that. And I'm just happy in my board texture analysis abilities and my hand reading abilities. And I'm more than happy to take one pair out of position up against that guy.
Sure. And, you know, that's just a value bet. You know, like I meant to be talking specifically about the concept of betting for protection, and why if you think that your bet is not going to get called by worse and it's not going to cause better to fold, why you might choose not to bet. I mean, if you believe, as it sounds like is the case with the scenarios our correspondent is asking about, that a bet is going to be called by hands that are worse than yours, and or more specifically that you're going to be ahead of your opponent's calling range when you bet, then you know, I would say that doesn't even really count as betting for protection. Like I think that maybe some of the value of your bet comes from just winning the pot immediately, but a decent amount of the value in that bet comes, as you say, by getting called by players who you know are calling with bad hands. And then it's just a matter of assessing whether or not the turn card, whether or not you still have good equity on the turn card.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do want to get back to preflop now, because I think this is turning into a really nice example of how your play over multiple streets fits together into an overall strategy. And I absolutely agree that you shouldn't be shoveling money into the pot every time you hit a good flop. I still do think that if you don't have good profitable situations when you hit good flops, then there might be something wrong with your pre-flop strategy. So you gave the example of 6-4 suited, where you can hit a pair and often fold, and that's okay because you're going to be able to play for stacks with a straight or a flush or well-concealed trips sometimes. And that's all well and good, but I do want to point out that you're playing in deeper games these days and you're not playing in 1-2 games. I think if you're playing with 100 big blinds at 1-2, one thing that makes your opponents bad is that they don't put a lot of money into the pot a lot of the time. Like, you know, actually, if you limp behind and if you flop a straight flush with 6-4, it's not at all guaranteed that you're going to win 100 big blinds or anything like it. Like if you're sitting with $1,500 at 2-5, then that's a situation. You know, if you have position on somebody else with who has 1,500 or more and you've got the 6-4 suited, then great. And I play that every time. And in fact, I think we've talked about this before, like if it folds to the other guy who's really deep stacked and he opens, I default to re-raising with a hand like 9-8 suited just because I want to set up good stack situations. You know, then everything changes, at least sometimes. I again think that that if our correspondent is playing in your standard casino 1-2-0 limit game, where actually a lot of people only have 50 blinds, not to say, you know, even if he is playing with 100 blinds or 125 blinds, I think there's something wrong if he doesn't have good situations when he flops a pair often.
I think to bring those two points together, he also just needs to better evaluate whether his like suited connected hand hit the flop well or not. You know, he might just be looking at things in the prism of, oh, I have a pair, but you know, as we know, not all pairs are created equal. So I think sometimes he's going to be in Andrew's situation and have made a correct pre-flop play, but then he needs to evaluate that this isn't the flop for his bottom pair. And then sometimes he's probably making the mistake Nate's pointing out as well, that he shouldn't have played pre-flop, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I also think this is something, were we talking about this on the air? I think actually we were just talking about this in the car from Red Rock to Harrah's, Andrew, where, you know, if you're going to be playing some of these extra hands, some of these 9-8 offsuits, and so, you know, there are spots where 9-8 offsuit is just a bread and butter good play before the flop. But sometimes people think that they're counting on an edge after the flop. I think if your opponents are giving you trouble in spots where you flop a second pair, that's a reason to think that your edge after the flop isn't as big as you think, which is not to shame you or anything. It's just to say that in a certain class of situations, your opponents aren't playing quite badly enough relative to you to make these fundamentally unprofitable plays turn into profitable plays. There's nothing wrong with that. But one of my tests for that isn't, am I making amazing hero calls with bottom pair? It's, can I easily fold one pair on the flop to action? You know, it's, you know, if I bet and get called, do I often get enough information from the call to know that the other guy has the jack on jack nine deuce? And then can I just check fold the turn easily? You know, that it's making good folding decisions, not getting stuck in these difficult spots is maybe even a better litmus test than your propensity to make hero calls as to whether you should be playing these extra hands before the flop.
Well, we actually have a hand sent to us that I think is, in some ways, isn't going to seem too similar to these situations, but I think a similar concept comes up where the hero gets into a spot where it's kind of tough for him to get called by worse or to fold out better. And this one, this, by the way, brings up a good way to get your hand read on the air, which is to have an awesome name. So this comes to us from Merry Old England, from a correspondent who calls himself Fat Harry Potter, which I enjoyed immeasurably. This is from a $5 tournament. The blinds were 1600, 3200 with a 400 ante. And the under the gun player essentially goes all in. He has 16,713, or just over five big blinds to start the hand. And he raises to 16,000. So he leaves 313 chips behind, because he paid the ante as well. He leaves 313 chips behind, but he functionally goes all in for five big blinds under the gun. There are three folds, and then a player with about 170K, so a little over 50 big blinds, calls the all in bet. And then the hero is in the small blind holding pocket kings. And he also has a little over 50 big blinds. So he's covered by the other player who has called the all-in, but not by terribly much. So I think our correspondent's main question comes on the flop. But let's start by talking about the pre-flop decision first. We've got an all-in for five big blinds. We've got a call. Hero is sitting in the small blind with about 50 big blinds, and he's holding pocket kings. What are you looking to do here?
I would re-raise.
Yeah, I would raise too.
What was your question, Gareth?
The size is going to be to some degree a function of how good the flat caller is, right?
Like, yeah.
The worse he is, the larger I feel we can get away with preserving his continuing range. You know, we're not, and also the worse he is, the less problems we're going to be having out of position value betting into a dry side pot, which we should expect those situations to come up frequently. If it's a good player, I might actually just...
Hey, you're saying you might just jam? I was thinking I might just jam against a good player.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm feeling silly.
35,000 in the pot, and you've got like 170,000 in your stack. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be an unreasonable jam. I think you might be better off raising an amount where... against a really good player, you might be better off leaving him room to jam on you with some hands that might have to fold to a jam, like an ace jack or something, and make it look. Because this is the sort of spot that comes up a lot when you're dealing with two very good players who will read the situation correctly. Like the under the gun player going all in for five big blinds does not need a great hand to do that. So the player who calls him does not need a great hand to do that either, particularly not. He's in somewhat late position. He still has four players stacked behind him, but I mean, for him to call there, like, he doesn't need jacks plus to make that call. You know, like, he can call certainly with like any pocket pair, a lot of aces, king queen, king jack. Yeah, I mean, he can be in there calling with some non-premium hands. Now, when the action comes back to Hero, when you look at it from Hero's perspective, there's like 12 or 13 big blinds in the pot and still no guarantee that anyone really has much of a hand. I mean, the under-the-gun player we know is on an extremely wide range. Hero could theoretically take a hand like a 10-9 suited here and figure, even though he's not ahead of under-the-gun, he has fine equity against him, considering, you know, Hero's only going to have to put five big blinds into the pot to have a shot at winning 12 or 13. And if Hero believes that he can drive out the guy who called the original shove, Hero could be raising to something like 50K, still give himself room to fold to a shove, and believe that if he can raise to 50K and drive out the guy who initially called the all-in bet, then he can have a really profitable spot. I mean, if he knew for sure that that guy was going to fold, I think Hero has a profitable spot with any two cards. So, I mean, it really comes down to how often he expects that first caller to fold. So if I were up against a really good player, I would know that really good player would know that it was a good spot for me to make a raise with a relatively wide range, and you know, there's a chance that he's going to rejam on me with a hand like an ace jack, because now there's another 15 big blinds in the pot that he's not convinced that I have a hand to put those 15 in the pot, and he could be jamming with a lot of stuff, so I'd want to give him room to do that.
How could he ever possibly fold ace jack like in that situation? You talk about it, right? Almost like it's a mistake, but I don't see how he could possibly fold if you make it 14 and a half big blinds and he has ace jack.
You're right. I mean, and that's what I mean, but I think he would be correct to fold it if Hero jammed.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Wait, whoa. Somebody
no, you're right.
Okay. One tenth of your mutual stacks were put in possibly blind, but almost certainly with a very wide under the gun. It's almost like you're playing 10 big blind poker with a good player and you're telling him to fold ace jack.
Okay. Yeah,
fine. Ace jack is a bad example. There exists some set of hands.
This is the thing. I was thinking, like, if you jam, he might call with king jack. You might call with a hand that you have, like, more than dominated. You might call
super
with
dominated.
A hand like king jack.
Right,
yeah. And I mean, how is he ever going to fold ace jack if you jam?
Okay.
I mean,
ace jack is
I think
a bad
the real
example.
Question is what he's going to do.
His rejamming range should be wider than his calling range, yes?
Right. So the question is, like, what hands can continue versus like 15 big blinds that can't continue versus 50.
Right.
And I think like a hand like pocket twos maybe makes a lot of sense in that situation as a hand that falls in that category.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking like if you make it 50K and or even a little less than that, 44K or something, and suggest that there's a possibility that you're going to fold to a jam, his jamming range ought to be wider than his range for just call. Like, there, I don't think there should exist a set of hands that will call a jam from you, but will fold if you only make it 50K.
I think we're not aces. Like,
I do think that we're getting into very read dependent territory here, because on the one hand you're saying that this player is good, and then on the other hand you're suggesting that he can be baited into making what seems like a ridiculous play with effectively very short stacks. I mean, it really depends on what kind of good player this good player is, in particular what he thinks of you. Like, if you think he's going to take this crazy exploitive play of rejamming on you with ace deuce offsuit or, you know, queen nine suited or something like that, if you just make it 44K, then great, go ahead and do it. But just from like a theory perspective, this is a bit like playing 11 big blinds blind versus blind, and if he limps then you make it 2.1 big blinds. You know, you probably shouldn't be thinking like, oh, this person's going to fold if I jam, you know. Like,
well, it's, I feel like one of the merits, if we're playing such a good player, is protecting our any two cards range that doesn't want to shove. We want kings to be in that range if we have a profitable, you know, go with 10-9 suited, like Andrew was saying, you know, ace deuce off.
That's an argument for putting kings in your jamming range, right?
I think Gareth is saying there might be some hands like ace deuce that he would want a 3-bet fold here.
Yeah.
I think that if this player is good and thinks that you are not terrible, he is going to play such that you do not have a profitable raise fold in this spot. Like, you might have an okay call along situation, but right. Again, with like the 11 big blinds thing, like, he's not going to let you have a profitable bluff raise to 2.1 big blinds if he limps with 12 big blind stacks, blind versus blind. So given that, I think theory suggests that we should try to optimize our jamming range. you know, we should maybe have a calling range and maybe have a jamming range. And we should try to optimize
betting range at all.
Against a good player, against your average sort of tournament player, like against John Q live tournament on a Saturday or whatever, like, then maybe we should. But if we're talking about how to play against a good player, then I would not have a raising range.
Yeah, I mean, let's come back to the actual example, which is that this is a $5 tournament and Hero has 16 hands, 16 hands on the guy who called the five big blind shove. I mean, what do you want to do in this case if we're assuming this is a random in a $5 tournament?
Yeah, I've raised enough to make it incorrect for him to call with ace 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should assume that this guy is not going to read the situation as well as a super good player is, and is not going to call a jam particularly light, but very likely will be willing to call another raise without thinking too much about what Hero's hand is, and just thinking like, oh, it's only X more for me to see the flop in a pot where there's already a ton of chips in the pot. Like, he's not going to be thinking a ton about what Hero's range might be. He's probably just going to say, oh, I can see the flop for only 30K more. Let's do that.
I put in 17 big blinds in this exact situation, I think.
And how do you arrive at that?
It's suspiciously big, but they're also not going to fold in my experience. But I feel like once you climb above that, people are going to fold. And then the stack to pot ratio is going to be good enough that, you know, if you get like a bad flop, you could jam. Like a non-dry flop, you might want to jam. But then you can also go small with that stack to pot ratio.
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer here is you just want to raise as much as you believe the villain will call with more or less his whole range. But I think that, Gareth, you're probably right that it's somewhere in the 15 to 17 big blind neighborhood, like approximately three times the amount of the original raise, an amount that'll offer villain somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 1 to see a flop, and an amount that'll make it very easy for you to get the rest of the money in the pot on any flop, which is, I think, what you're going to do. I mean, once you see the flop with a stack to pot ratio of 1, I don't think there are really flops that you're going to be looking to check fold with kings. Okay, so what ends up happening in the hand, Hero makes it about 40K, which I think is a little on the small side. This is going to be something like, this is more like 12 or 13 big blinds, and we're saying we think Hero could probably get away with making it 15 or 17. And it may not seem like a huge difference, but considering that there's already 12 in the pot, putting an extra 2 or 3 big blinds in there, it cuts down pretty substantially on the stack to pot ratio, and it cuts down pretty substantially on the odds that the villain is getting to see the flop, and just getting more money into the pot now. I mean, right now, you know that kings is the best hand. After the flop, there are going to exist flops such as the one we're about to see, where you are no longer sure that kings is the best hand. But right now, like, you're very sure that kings is a monster hand that you're eager to shovel money into the pot with. And I think you want to do that. I mean, this is a clear case of front-loading value. Like, you have the virtual nuts right now, and you want to put as much money into the pot as you believe your opponent will call. Your objective here is not even necessarily to get called by 100% of your opponent's range, as much as it is to maximize the amount of money that he'll put in on average. So if you figure, like, he'll call 13 big blinds with 100% of his range, or he'll call 17 big blinds with 80% of his range, or you'd rather go for the 17 big blinds with 80% of his range. You want to get the money in now, because this is a much more profitable spot for you than on average you'll have on the flop. We also know that villain has shown interest in his hand pre-flop already. We don't know that villain will still be interested in his hand after seeing the flop. Or if villain has a hand like 10-9 suited, there are going to be a number of flops where he has absolutely nothing and he's not going to put any more money into the pot, but he probably is going to be willing to pay, as Gareth is saying, 15 to 17 big blinds to see the flop with that hand. So Hero makes it 40K, and the under the gun player calls off his last 313 chips, not surprisingly. The other player calls as well. So we see the flop with about 100K in the pot and about 130K left in the effective stack. So the stack to pot ratio now is not quite 1 to 1, but getting close to it. And I think, as we discussed, we would have rather had a higher stack to pot ratio, because I still think that there aren't really flops that Hero can check fold. I mean, we end up getting an ace 9-6 rainbow flop, which is obviously a pretty bad flop for pocket kings. Nonetheless, I don't really see Hero getting away from this hand. And this is part of the reason why I would have rather put more money in pre-flop, because I think the money is going to go in pretty much all the time anyway. And I feel better about putting money in pre-flop than I do about putting money in on after the the flop, you know, not even knowing what the flop is. I just think, you know, pre-flop, kings is the second nuts. After the flop, it's very rarely that strong.
So when you say money's going to go in anyway, do you think that the money is actually going to go in, or we're going to be willing to put money in all the time?
We're going to be willing to put money in. I don't think, and that was part of the problem, is I don't think that villain is necessarily committed to his hand post-flop. Like, I think he could easily have a 10-9 suited that's just going to whiff certain flops, but that he's going to be willing to see a flop with for a third of the effective stacks.
I'm going to say that his range is pretty ace-x, where X can be, you know, 10 or jack or something like that, ace-x heavy and pocket pair heavy. So I would start by checking, certainly.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I also like starting by checking.
I think we should talk first about whether we feel committed to the hand.
Yeah, is it crazy to check fold here?
That's what I want to ask.
No.
If you think his range is ace-x heavy, I mean, are you thinking here can get away from this?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I've played pots like this in cash and tournament, and you know, like, what hands is he calling with the first time around? If he thinks that he himself is a big stack, he might take a shot with a hand like queen 10 or something like that, but a lot of that's going to be a hand like ace 10. He says, oh, that's a pretty good hand to play for five big blinds, I call. And pocket pairs too, where he's not really thinking about constructing three bet ranges. And sure, he could have queen 10 or king 9 or a hand like that, or really a hand like king jack, but then you raise. And then a lot of these people are going to think, oh, this person has told me that he has a real hand. I have read the Harrington books. I have put money into the pot. My opponent has told me something. I'm going to respond to what he has told me. I fold my queen jack, you know, or whatever. So I do think a lot of the hands that are left, like, whereas with ace jack, sometimes actually he'll fold to that. But, you know, you do your Bayesian update. I think a lot of the hands that are left are pocket eights, ace 10 suited, ace jack offsuit in there. Things like that. The occasional ace king, sure, the occasional king queen, you know, something like that. But I do think his range is ace x and pocket pair heavy. And yeah, I think sometimes I would check planning to fold. There's a tricky thing where if it goes like check jam, then all of a sudden I think a hand like pocket sevens that he's losing his mind with starts to look kind of plausible. But like if it goes check check, and then the turn comes a jack and it goes check, and then he bets like one third of the remaining money, I might look to either fold then, although that's not really great, but like maybe call once more then fold the river or a hand like that. Like, actually, I think would not always put the rest of my money in the pot. And I think maybe Gareth agrees with me.
Yeah, honestly, I'd be like, we're gonna have over 35 big blinds in a $5 tournament. Now, of the three of us, I'm clearly the biggest tournament fish, but I'd be looking to check fold here. And I think his I think Nate's ace x read is quite strong. Like, even with an ace on the board, I feel like he's combinatorically gonna have so many ace x hands, and our equity is quite poor against that hand. I mean, starting with a check just seems like super clear to me.
Yeah, I think so, and that's part of the point that I wanted to make. You guys are starting to sell me on being able to get away from this. Part of the point I wanted to make, though, is that even if you do decide that you're committed to the pot, I still think that the checking is the way you want to go. Like, you kind of have two options here. One is check, evaluate, kind of with the thinking that if you get the sense that villain has an ace, that you can get away from your hand without putting too much more, if any more, money into the pot. And the second is decide that you're committed to the pot and you're not going to be folding here. But I think regardless, what you want to do is check. Because I mean, I can imagine, even if we saw this flop, if we had taken the Gareth line, we put 17 big blinds in pre-flop, now we're seeing the flop with a 1-to-1 stack to pot ratio, or even higher than that. I mean, say we see it with a 0.5 stack to pot ratio. I mean, so some point where you decide we are over the commitment threshold, we're not getting away from kings, even though it's a pretty bad flop for us. I still think that you don't want to be the one bet. Even once you make a commitment decision, you decide I'm going to go with this hand, it still matters how the money goes in. And you would like to be in better shape against villain stack off range if you can be. Now, if we were seeing the flop with a hand like 7-8, where we flop an open-ended straight draw, we think the stacks are big enough that we're gonna put the money in. With a hand like 8-7, you want to maximize your fold equity. So if you decide when you see the flop with 8-7 and you decide I'm gonna be going with this hand, you want to be the one doing the betting, because you try to get your opponent to fold a hand like pocket queens or pocket tens or jack nine or whatever that's actually ahead of your 8-7. If you make the same commitment decision with a hand like pocket kings, you don't want your opponents to fold those hands. I mean, you know your opponent's not going to fold an ace, so you're not going to try to get them off of an ace. What you're going to try to do is get your opponent to put money into the pot with hands that are worse than yours. That might mean giving him room to bluff. It might mean, you know, letting the flop and or the turn check through so that he'll feel a little bit better about a hand like queens or jacks or 10-9 and be willing to put money into the pot on later streets, whereas he might not on the flop. But, you know, just because you decide that you're going to go with the hand doesn't necessarily mean that you want to be the one shoveling the money into the pot. And certainly if you decide that you're not going to go with the hand, then you want to try to put as little money into the pot as possible and minimizing your risk of getting bluffed.
I think that's all right, and I think that was really well explained. As far as this hand goes, I think we would be remiss if we didn't say once more that this is a partially protected pot. We have, you know, we're playing for the side pot now, and the main pot has like 18 big blinds in it. There are antes, and that's going to make the guy on the button even less likely to move all in with sixes or whatever, or you know, bet half the pot with sixes or whatever. So I think that's another reason for having our commitment threshold be much higher than we initially thought it might be. And I think this happens for social reasons a lot. Like, people understand that they shouldn't call off their chips too often, or they feel like they shouldn't. And once they're committed, like, that often makes them think that they should do it aggressively. And that can often be a very big mistake, especially in tournaments. Like, people just hate, sorry, I've got the main event fresh in my mind, and people just hate, you know, calling the river for the rest of their stack and then having to sort of slouch away from the table. I thought I was getting the pot odds. You know, they just don't like that, you know, like, and
yeah. That was like a really good Eeyore impression, Tony.
Thank you.
The pod odds.
Yeah, there's room for a Photoshop there, I think.
Yeah, our hero here says that pre-flop, he puts his opponent on pocket nines or better. Ace-queen, ace-king, pocket jacks, pocket queens, which I think would fall into the pocket nines or better category. So he says he believes his opponent would fold ace-10, ace-jack, or pairs lower than nines. So it seems like after calling the second re-raise, he's putting his opponent on a relatively strong range. And it seems like, because he says, I convince myself that he only has ace-king or ace-queen left that's beating me. But, you know, it might seem like, well, nines, tens, jacks, queens, kings, aces, that's a lot of hands versus ace, king, ace, queen, that's only two hands. But there are a lot more combinations of ace, king, ace, queen in the deck than there are of those pocket pairs. I guess that's a little less true since here is holding two of the kings and we're looking at one ace on the flop. But, you know, against that range on an ace high flop, Hero's equity is not great, even if villain is willing to put the money in with all of those hands. And this comes back again to the importance of, even if you decide you're committed to the pot, you want to make sure that villain puts money into the pot with the bottom of his range, because against the top of it, you're absolutely screwed. I mean, you're drawing a one out against ace king. So you really want to make sure, if you're going to stack off here, that villain puts money into the pot with his pocket jacks, because otherwise you're in terrible shape.
I mean, let's just do the arithmetic, right? So 3 times 2 is 6. That's 6 combinations of ace king. 3 times 4 is 12. So that's a total of 18 combinations of ace king, ace queen. And there are 6 combinations of each pocket pair. So if you think that there are, What did he say? Jacks and queens, tens, jacks and queens, something like that.
Yeah, tens, jacks, queens, kings, aces.
Yeah. So if there are three, so there are exactly the same number of pocket pairs and ace, king, ace, queen combination wise.
And he's certainly more liable to flat ace, jack than he is to flat queens. You know, like, obviously this guy's, we all sort of disagree. Even it's super generous. Even if we go with the super generous range, I think it's still much more ace x than pocket pairs.
Mm-hmm. So the correspondent says, I figure I have to rep the ace on the flop, which is the part of this hand that I think I want to disagree with most vehemently. I don't think there's any reason that you have to or would want to represent the ace on the flop. Again,
yeah, I mean, so like if somebody has a worse hand than ace, like, you want him to think that he's beaten not by kings, but by hands one notch better than kings? Like,
it comes down to people feeling a need to bet for information. And you know, this is a point that, you know, I've emphasized a lot of different places in writing, and I know we've talked about on the show before, but Nate, I think the point you were getting at with this being a protected pot is that you can actually kind of check here for information and maybe expect that a lot of people aren't, either they're not going to bluff into a dry side pot, or that they're not going to bet a hand like pocket queens into a dry side pot, where with the ace out there, your opponent might be thinking, what's the point in betting queens? You know, either my opponent's going to fold or I'm going to get called by an ace. So it might be the case that you could actually check here for information and assume that your opponent would only bet if he actually had the ace. And in that case, rather than betting and saying, well, it'll cost me, as Mihiro ends up betting 40,000 on the flop, and you can say, well, if I bet, it'll cost me 40,000 chips, but I'll find out whether my opponent has an ace. Or you can check and assume that your opponent will very rarely bet the flop unless he has an ace. And then without costing yourself anything, you can find out whether he has an ace. I'd much rather save myself the 40,000 chips if I'm going to do that. As it happens, Hero gets called on the flop, and then it seems like he kind of goes back on his read, which is another mistake that you don't really want to make. Because then he says, even after being called on the flop, when he was trying to represent the ace, then he still says, I figure I can only be beat by ace king or ace queen, and I decide to jam in the last of my chips, which it seemed like initially he thought his opponent was going to be folding hands worse than an ace on the flop, which was his reason for betting the flop. So this is another thing that you don't want to do is go back on your read. I mean, if you make the decision, I'm going to bet the flop to find out whether my opponent has an ace, then once you bet the flop and you get called, then you need to say, okay, I guess my opponent has an ace. Now it's time to check fold. I think putting the rest of your chips into the pot after you've already gotten the information that you were looking for, you know, now you're not even making use really of the information that you paid for in the first place. And the results here, Hero ends up losing to ace 10, although the all-in player had pocket fives and hit a five on the turn. So he in fact is the one to ship the majority of the pot, but Hero does end up losing to an ace 10 that his opponent has, which I guess goes towards your point, Nate, that Villain's Range was even more weighted towards aces than the Hero assumed.
I think that's right. But thank you for sending in the hand. We appreciate it, especially with the awesome pseudonym. Speaking of awesome pseudonyms, we've also heard back from Botswana Nick, who signed off that way on his email and is a pretty awesome guy. And he had a hand from Johannesburg. So Johannesburg, we will get to you, Botswana Nick, and all the other people with awesome names and really good questions who have written to us. Thanks to everybody who has written in.
Okay, so our second hand is coming from Gareth. This is $25.50 Zoom game. You want to run us through it?
Sure. I raise Jack 10 suited under the gun. I'm pretty deep with the only caller on the button.
This is a six-handed game, we should emphasize.
Yeah, sorry, six max. Yeah, I have Jack 10 of hearts under the gun in a six-handed cash game. I open and get one caller on the button. We're both pretty deep stacked, and I flop straight. The only problem is there are three spades on the board, so it's ace, king, queen, all spades, and I've flopped Broadway. I guess it's pretty straightforward continuation bet for value. Mm-hmm. My opponent calls. Important point about my opponent is that he's a regular, plays four tables, and tight aggressive normally, but he has yet to three bet an under the gun open. So let me get the number right. He's had 60 opportunities to three bet an under the gun open. He hasn't done it once. He has 35 in position opportunities to three bet an under the gun open, and he hasn't done that once. So that played a lot into my decision, basically.
So you're assuming that because he may well not be three betting the very top of his the very best hands pre-flop, that like ace king, ace queen, aces, kings, queens can all be in his range.
Yeah,
I think it's worth mentioning too, in terms of, you know, thinking of your straight as a value hand, even though there's three spades on the board, you know, how different a flop like ace, king, queen of spades is from a flop like 7, 8, 9 of spades, where you also would have flopped a straight. The likelihood of your opponent playing two spades that don't have an ace, king, or queen in them is relatively low compared to the likelihood of him playing ace, x of spades. So the number, especially when you're close to 100 big blinds deep, the number of combinations of ace, x of spades your opponent is going to play is a lot higher than the number of combinations of like 9x of spades he's going to play. So on an ace, king, queen, spade flop, the likelihood of your opponent having flopped a flush is much lower than it would be on a 7, 8, 9 spades flop. And this, I think, will continue to be true when a fourth spade shows up on the board, that your opponent is much less likely to be calling you with a bear like jack or 10 of spades pre-flop than he is to be calling you with ace x one spade.
Yeah, definitely. That's a very good explanation for part of my river decision. And also, when he's facing an under the gun open, I don't see him flatting a lot of hands that just have the jack of spades in them with another card not of that suit.
So, right, like a jack nine offsuit or something.
Yeah, or like an ace jack offsuit with the jack of spades. Jack of spades hands are pocket jacks with a spade, pocket tens with a spade. Mm-hmm. Those are the two main types of hands that have spades and actually block some combinations of jacks and tens here. So.
Right. So when you talk about betting and getting called on this flop, you're thinking about getting value out of, we already mentioned, like the two pair and set combinations you think are in his range. What other kind of stuff are you looking to get called by when you bet the flop?
Well, definitely those jacks and tens, I guess as light as nines or eights with a spade. And for the most part, I think that's it. He should have a raising range here deep that are hands, you know, like maybe seven, eight of spades, eight, nine of spades. I think like when he calls and he calls the turn bet on a blank, he's really he's indicating he has a hand that he likes, but unfortunately he feels like he can't raise it.
So if he had raised the flop, what would you have done? Let's say you bet $2.50 into a pot of 358. If your opponent had raised to 750,
that is an interesting question. I don't have a answer right away.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's worth considering. Like, I guess you have to ask yourself, A, could he do this as a bluff, and B, could he do this for value slash protection with a hand that's worse than mine? Like, is it conceivable that he might raise a set of aces here, which I don't see a lot of reasons why he shouldn't. Like, a lot of the same reasons why Jack 10 is pretty likely to be the best hand right now. Pocket aces is also pretty likely to be the best hand right now from villain's perspective, but there are reasons why he might not want to see another card. So I don't think it would be terrible if he were to raise with a hand worse than yours, thinking that he has the best hand.
Yeah, that makes sense. My instinct was to fold because I'm out of position with the stack depth involved. I don't have, once he raises, he's really taking away my opportunities to make value bets on later streets. And yeah, I just don't have a lot of playability in this situation. There's not a lot of runouts that I can call on happily. I basically have to hope the board doesn't pair and a spade doesn't come and a jack or a 10 doesn't also arrive, and for him to be like overvaluing top set. And yeah, we have like we don't have 200 big blinds back, but we're well over 160. Mm-hmm. So
to that point, I also thought that if he's going to try to bluff you here, I think he should and usually will be planning to fire multiple barrels. Like, let's say he has two sixes or a hand like that, comes ace, king, queen, and you bet, and he decides to try to run you off whatever hand you have. I think that I wouldn't be expecting you to fold a lot of your range right away.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe yeah. I should, I don't know. But I would be ready to apply more pressure later. I would be planning a multi-street bluff a lot of the time. And that makes me like your plan of folding if you aren't planning on calling down a lot. It makes me like that plan.
Yeah, this is why I distinguish between like whether you think he's raising worse for value and how much you think he's raising as a bluff. Because I actually think it's kind of ironically, if you think he's raising as a bluff, you probably ought to just fold. If you think he's raising worse for value, then I think there are times when, for instance, a fourth spade comes and you're able to check it down when he has a set of aces, or maybe after you call the flop, then he'll be willing to check the turn with a set or with two pair or something like that. Like I think that he might actually slow down if he has a hand worse than yours. Whereas if it comes down to how does your hand fare as a bluff catcher, if we think about other hands in your range, like I'd much rather bet call aces, kings, queens, ace, king, yeah, exactly. Like hands that have redraws rather than like 10 jack, where as you say, there's really like there's no card that's going to improve your hand. Like your hand is only going to get worse. So unless we have some reason to believe villain is going to slow down, which I think is possible if you believe he could be raising a hand like ace king or pocket kings here, then he might slow down on later streets. But yeah, as Nate says, if you're expecting him to keep betting with whatever he raised with, then you probably just want to throw this away because it's not going to get any better than it is now.
This is kind of interesting because I'm pretty close to the top of my bet range in a lot of ways, but I'm actually not close to the top of my bet call range. Like the bet call range I'm going to construct is probably going to have ace jack with the jack of spades, but not this particular hand. So
I really like this discussion, and I also like how we were trying to make this a short discussion, yet we spent a lot of time discussing this like counterfactual situation.
Well, Andrew asked the question that I couldn't answer right away. So
okay, so what actually happens? Hero bets $2.50 into a pot of 358, and villain calls, and we get the seven of hearts on the turn, which you know, changes very little unless villain floated you with pocket sevens with a seven of spades, in which case he likes his hand a little bit more. But that turn is about as blank as it could be.
So no reason to not continue with a bet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, still like a lot of the same hands that you think are calling the flop. Probably like the pocket nine, pocket eights with a spade are going to fold at this point. But the if he has ace jack with a spade, which I know you were saying he might not, certainly if he has like the sets or the two pairs, he's probably going to be willing to call again. So you bet 650 into 836. And our called again. How are you feeling at this point? Any worry about him having a flesh?
No, unless he has the royal now, basically.
Mm-hmm. Like the anything else you think he'd be raising?
Yes, definitely on the turn. Like at this stack depth, like players who are four tabling these stakes, who I see often, are looking to get big cans paid off. So more than thinking about protecting their range or this or that, they're looking to get stacks in with 9-10 of spades here on the turn, I think.
So now the river is where it gets really interesting, because the river is the deuce of spades. So now we're looking at four spades on the board. You still have a straight, so you have the nut non-flush.
Yeah.
Let's talk through your decision now. There's about $21 in the pot. There's $78 left in the effective stacks. How are you deciding how to proceed now?
I mean, my decision making was pretty simple, actually, in game. I looked at two things. The fact that he's never 3-bet an under the gun open, and the timing with which he called the turn. Those are the only, I'd like to say I was like amalgamating like 10 factors, you know, but those are the only two things I actually thought about as all the other tables zoomed around me. Like when I just put those two things together, I just thought the only hands that beat me here are two combos of jacks with a spade, two combos of jacks of tens with a spade, and that's it. Other than that, I have the best hand. And if he called the turn as fast as he did, like, it's one of those situations where folding was out of the question and raising was out of the question. You put that together with he's never 3-bet and under the gun open, and it just looks like he has aces and queens, aces and kings, or, you know, a set a huge amount of the time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like from his perspective, he's going to have trouble folding absolutely strong hands, but it also looks really suspicious to bet here. I just thought I could get called. I need to make a smaller size in relation to the pot to get called, but
yeah, and I'm kind of imagining here, like, some listeners may be feeling some discomfort about trying to value bet a straight when there's a fourth spade on the board. And I think, you know, we did try to emphasize on the flop how, you know, the fact that the three spades that came on the flop are the three highest spades really affects the number of both flushes and flush draws that are in people's ranges on the flop. These people are playing those low spades so much less often. And the other thing to think about on the river is, you know, it's not just that you're excited about betting, although, I mean, there's good reasons why you should be, but also that you need to think about betting in the context of the alternatives. Like, you know, you can either bet, you can check call, or you can check fold. Check calling makes sense mostly if you're trying to catch bluffs, which in this case, we don't really have any reason to think that he's getting to the river with a hand that he feels like he needs the bluff. You know, if he has a set of kings on the river, he might consider it good enough to value bet, but he's not going to think of it as a hand that needs the bluff. I mean, the most likely bluffing hands are busted draws, and in this case, the draw got there. So I don't think there's any sense in check calling, which is something that I think a lot of people might be inclined to do here. When they see a bet river card, they'll sort of say to themselves, well, they'll treat check calling as a compromise. And they'll say, well, you know, I my hand isn't so good anymore, so I'm not going to bet it for value, but I will check and call a bet. And here I think Villain's calling range is going to be a lot wider than his betting range. So you'd rather the money go into the pot with him calling than that the money go into the pot with him betting. And then the other option here would be to check and fold, which I think would make sense if you didn't think that Villain was going to call your bet with worse. You know, you could check and say, well, you know, if I think Villain won't call a bet with a set of kings, then maybe I can check, and if he checks behind, then I'll win. If he bets, he can only have a flush, and then I can throw my hand away. You know, that would make sense if you didn't believe you could get called by worse. But I think you're right that as long as you bet small enough, there's plenty of reason to believe that he will call you with worse. So there's really no need for you to either to check and call or to check and fold.
Yeah, plus there's Twitter equity here to consider. Like, it depends on the time of day. Like, if I think Nate is going to be awake. I don't know. Yeah. I thought it was pretty, like, once I thought through it, I thought it was clearly the best option.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Nate, do you have anything you want to add to this before we get to the results?
No, I said most of what I want to say. I do think, at least in the live games I play, that when there are these quote-unquote scary boards, and then when they get quote-unquote scarier, this is where you see a lot of triple barrel bluffs from people who don't often do that, and where those can be a big part of people's ranges. So like in a live game, it comes, sorry, raises before the flop, and it comes like jack 10 6 with two spades, and then they bet continuation bet, and then the turn comes a 9, and then they bet again, and then the river comes another spade, and then they bet yet another time. That's a great situation where a lot of people would have controlled the pot somewhere with a hand like queens or something in a live game, and they just say, oh, I have two overcards, I bet the flop, and then, oh, oh, there's something else I can represent. I bet the turn, and then the river comes, and oh, maybe I could have had, you know, the nut flush draw, so I'm going to bet again, and the pot's too big to give up on now. So I think that from the villain's perspective, I don't know how these Zoom games play in that much detail, but I do think that Gareth stands a chance of looking bluffy, just because it's pretty easy to look at Gareth's line and think, like, what? Ace-King? Is he playing that way? No. It's like, really, like, how many hands does this joker have, you know? And, you know, call with a set or whatever you have. So, nice hand. Very nice hand.
But, yeah, this poor guy has no idea what kind of joker he's up against, because Gareth bets $11 into a $21 pot, which I think is good sizing choice here. It makes it very hard for villain to fold a hand like a set of kings, which it turns out is precisely what villain has. So I think excellent instance of Gareth making use of the poker tracker stats that he has on this player to look at that number about never having three bet and under the gun raise, and how important a bit of information that is to tell us what kind of hand villain could have and be calling down with, and how much of this hand is dependent on preflop hand reading generally, like recognizing that strong non-flush hands are in villain's range and strong flush hands more or less are not.
It's going to be hard to improve on most of what you say in this podcast, so that's a good example of it.
All right, well, thank you, Gareth, for coming on here and for your excellent editing work as well. Maybe it's worth mentioning here for a second, because we've gotten a lot of emails from people about a disparity in volume between the bumper music we play between segments and the segments themselves. And at this point, you know, I kind of want to ask people whether they're still experiencing that, because I know Gareth,
I think that should have been resolved for the last episode. I think those criticisms are merited. Basically, if the last episode you felt like they weren't resolved, then it's something that is not so obvious.
Because I'm still getting emails from people, but I don't know if these are people who have listened to the most recent episode and are still having this problem, or if these people are you know, a couple episodes behind. Because as of, I think it was episode, let's just say 40. I mean, if you heard the problem in today's episode or in last week's episode with Bill Ardeen, episode 40, then let us know, because otherwise we believe that the problem has been fixed, and we do appreciate those of you who were experiencing the problem letting us know about it. And definitely, Gareth, we've appreciated you doing all of the audio editing that you've done for us.
Yeah, I would just change the adjective you use from excellent to, you know, like better than mediocre.
Affordable.
Affordable. Effortful. I don't know. Spirited, but excellent. Yes.
Spirited. I like spirited.
Excellent. Maybe not so much.
Thank you for your spirited and cost-effective work.
And have fun in Galway.
Yeah. Thank you. You guys know it's been my pleasure.
I get the sense I'm being sort of unnecessarily salty today.
That makes for good material, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's possible I've offended both of you already today.
I think we could use more saltiness on the show.
All right.
How did you offend me today, Nate? I didn't get that so far.
Oh yeah, no, I might have been a bit flippant when I said, "Oh, we'll talk about this. Gareth can advance his own moral nihilism."
Oh right.
No, I think Gareth loves that.
That's my prediction. Yeah, I'm used to that by now. So. No worries, sir.
We're leaving all this in the show, right?
I'm in favor.
Yeah, we could do that.
I'm already recording, so I figure to avoid breaking the rule against recording a lot of stuff that we don't ultimately send to Gareth as part of the show, I pretty much have to think that we're on the air already, right?
Right.
So how are you?
I'm good. I am flourishing in cloudy Trondheim, Norway. But I'm escaping on Friday, so that should be good. The weather here is terrible. I've spent the weekend with my eventual in-laws. I don't know. that's what's up with me, I guess.
So you've said this before. Do you refer to all of your girlfriend's families as eventual in-laws, or do you actually think you're going to marry this girl? I mean, if so, congratulations, and that's wonderful.
I hope she doesn't listen to the show, because I got to keep an air of mystery to myself. But yeah, things are going well with Anna.
Very good.
And yeah, she's in Oslo for the weekend for a bachelorette party. So it's just been me and her parents all weekend. And yeah, her mom couldn't be a better host, to the point of like Anna was trying to argue that she shouldn't be making dinner all the time because we're both like fully adult and we don't need to report home at like 7 o'clock every night. But yeah, I've been here almost 5 weeks and I can say with clear confidence that Anna lost that war pretty handily. So I've been eating well. It's been very, very nice staying here.
So should we fill in some backstory here? You're in Norway visiting...
visiting Anna, my girlfriend. We've been...
Whom you met in...
Buenos Aires, actually. We met in Buenos Aires for 3 days or so, 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Yeah, we've spent time together now in a few places since then. So kind of we reunited in Lima on like we weren't together at the time, but she emailed me and said, "Hey, are you still in Lima?" Because she knew I was leaving in March. And I said, "Yes, come to Lima," because I'm here for like 4 more days. And then she actually took like a 24-hour bus from Ecuador following that email exchange. And we spent 4 days together and we've been together since. So
nice. It looks like we lost Nate, actually.
Yeah, I see that.
What a fish cake.
I see him as green.
Really?
I just lost him on my...
Yeah.
Oh, he's back again. Maybe he's on a shaky wireless. So, how's it going with you?
We have nothing to talk about. No, it's good. I'm also chasing a girl.
Oh, yeah?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Oh, right. How's that? Not your neck of the woods, I'd imagine.
I've only been here a couple of days, but it's been so far so good. We're right around the corner from a Whole Foods, so how bad can it be?
Right. So your dietary indulgences are intact?
Yeah, although we're also in an extended stay hotel, so the cooking facilities are limited, but we're getting by.
Any word from working class hero?
I just messaged him, and I received nothing in response. Yeah, you really missed out not being in Vegas this year. Really good time.
Yeah.
And you almost got replaced.
Almost got replaced by Carlos, you mean?
Carlos.
That was unbelievably good episode.
It was crazy. Yeah. Like, because we, I talked to him for a while. Like, Nate was late getting to, or actually, I probably miscommunicated our start time to him. But so Carlos and I were hanging out for like 20 minutes before Nate came up to the room. And then, like, we went to dinner with Carlos afterwards. And we both had the sense that we just wanted to have a microphone around all the time, like, recording every word that he said, because there was so much good stuff that just, like, didn't even make it on there. Like, he was making fun of the, Jonathan Little and a couple other people from, I think, a Sit and Go Icons, who they like, he was like, yeah, they like, you know, got this mansion and I don't even remember where it was, but like, they like got a mansion somewhere and we're like playing Sit and Goes from there. And I was like, you don't need a mansion to play poker. You can do that from a Brazilian lady's sofa.
The joke about the cents on the menu.
Yeah, that was killer.
It was like straight out of the Seinfeld, Chris Rock like repertoire. Yeah. Like perfect delivery
and perfect for that shit. Yeah.
I laughed pretty loud. Of course, I remember the episode where with Nico where you talked about being horrified when he opened the mini fridge.
Yeah.
So I was in a similar situation, like going to cafes here in Norway. Like I was horrified basically all the time, and I don't mind spending money either. Like I'm not a responsible adult, but I was equally horrified. Still a horrific scene. Yeah.
So nice when back. I got dropped, I was asking if Anna's mother would come on the show. No? Okay. Probably not. I'm guessing.
I don't know if that's, can I ask why? I mean, like,
people love you and people want to know what's going on in your life. And, I think having your girlfriend's mother on the show would really give our listeners what they want.
I don't know. I think, the smoke and mirrors are still in effect, you know, so I don't know if she'd have that much interesting things to say. Except that I'm polite and I eat all the food she gives me. So.
All right.
Well, should we just start over from the beginning?
Hello and welcome to episode 40. Hello and welcome to episode 40 of the Thinking Poker Podcast.
This is 41.
Yeah. Oh.